Well, thank you very much. Good morning to you. It's really good to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity to lead you on thinking through what is, as Steve said, a critical subject, I think, at this time. I think it's true to say that probably over the last 50 years or so, there has been what we could describe as a dramatic cultural shift in attitudes towards homosexuality and same-sex relationships. And I think we can see that shift culturally in a number of different ways in our society. So I'm sure that you all, being very committed and busy in gospel ministry, don't have an opportunity to watch the soaps. But, of course, many in our congregations do, and particularly younger people. And I tend to find, I don't know about you, but I tend to find that actually many of our younger people now are more likely to get their sexual ethics from EastEnders and Coronation Street than they are to get it, sadly, from the Bible's teaching. And what we tend to find now is that on the soaps, you'll find plenty of same-sex couples. And gone are those days where it used to be the stereotype of the typically camp, effeminate gay man or the butch lesbian woman. Now what you tend to find is that pretty much every relationship that's represented on TV would be just the ordinary guys or the ordinary women next door. Nothing in particular that would mark them out as being gay. Openly gay celebrities are no longer sidelined. There used to be a time when if somebody was gay or bisexual, they would do pretty much anything possible to cover that up if they were famous. But those days are pretty much gone now. Now, an openly gay celebrity generally finds that their sexuality is an asset. It adds to their popular appeal or to their commercial value. And if ever you wanted proof that our culture has changed so dramatically, surely it is Welsh rugby international Gareth Thomas there on the top left. Him being able to publicly come out and declare himself to be a gay man, that really provides all the proof you could want that our culture has changed. That would never have happened, probably in fact not even 10 years ago, but certainly not a generation ago. Of course, as Steve has already mentioned, same-sex marriage seems to be on its way into the statute books. There are possibilities, of course, of that bill being disrupted in the House of Lords, but one feels that it's likely to be a temporary disruption, even if that does happen. It seems to be on its way into the statute books. Of course, that began with the introduction of the Civil Partnership Bill some years ago, and now, say, the Commons has more or less came out and said, I do. There are a number of MPs resisting it, but it seems to be that is the way we're heading. We're heading towards a redefinition now of marriage, certainly in a state sense. It's not just this country. Around the world, leaders are now expressing themselves to be in favour of same-sex marriage. You may have picked up on the news last week. I was, I think, driving somewhere and listening to BBC Radio 4, and they were having live the first gay marriage taking place in France, and they were sort of broadcasting that. So it's happening all around the world. Here's President Obama last May, who said, I hesitated on gay marriage, but I've just concluded that for me personally, it's important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married. And you can imagine over in the USA, that caused quite a storm. Attitudes are probably a little bit harsher than they would be over here, and he didn't win himself many friends, let's say, certainly on the right of politics by making that very, very bold statement. And of course, Steve mentioned unnamed people. I'm going to name one because he's come out and he said he wants a discussion and he wants a debate. This is Steve Chalk in his article, A Matter of Integrity, back in January of this year. When we refuse to make room for gay people to live in loving, stable relationships, we consign them to lives of loneliness, secrecy, fear, and even of deceit. I'll take issue with that statement, but we'll maybe pick up on that a little bit later. It's one thing, he says, to be critical of a promiscuous lifestyle, but shouldn't the church consider nurturing positive models for permanent and monogamous homosexual relationships? Now, Steve is just one of a number of leaders. I only name him simply because he has gone public himself. He says he wants this debate. But a number of prominent church leaders now moving in that direction. Well, of course, the question is, and that's the question that I'm assuming we're wanting to answer this morning, or at least begin to answer, is how should we respond to this cultural shift in popular opinion? I tend to find there are a number of different reactions amongst Christians. Sometimes you get a mixture of these reactions. So there are some who believe that actually the emphasis, all the focus, should be on protesting, lobbying of Parliament, and praying for church. You know, of course, there's something good to be said about all of those things. We should certainly be engaged with our political leaders. We should certainly be praying for them and so on. We should be standing up for marriage. But sometimes I wonder if that is actually too much of a focus. Is that the impression that the church is given, that actually what we're doing is we're a protesting organisation, and so we're very good sometimes, I think, at protesting at sinful lifestyles, and I don't see that focus when I look at the gospel. I don't see Jesus coming into the world to protest at sinful lifestyles. I see him coming into the world to proclaim good news to sinful people. As I say, it's not that that's saying that it's wrong to be involved and engaged in lobbying and prayer and so on. Of course not. But I wonder whether that really is where our emphasis should be. And again, let's think that through over the course of this morning. So that's one reaction. There are others, of course, who are very much being persuaded by the Steve Chalk type of argument that perhaps it really is time for the church to, to kind of move on and accept that our culture has changed and that we're just sort of basically out of date. So that's another reaction as well. Amongst all the various reactions, I want to just suggest this morning that really, if we're true evangelical Christians, the question we ought to be asking is this question that I've put up here. Is the gospel good news for gay people? I suggest to you that is the most important question this morning. It's actually even more important than this issue about the authority of the Bible. I know that's a big concern, but I want to suggest that the most important question is the gospel good news for gay people. Apostle Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Why are you not ashamed, Paul? Well, I'm not ashamed because it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. Everyone who believes. No exceptions, no exclusions. No one is excluded from the scope or the reach of the gospel. And another reaction I find among some Christians is that we do believe what God's word says about same-sex practice, but we're kind of becoming ashamed of it because, well, let's face it, it's not popular, is it, to stand up and say, well, actually, I agree. I believe that God says no to all sex outside of marriage. That is not popular in our culture today. And so we kind of hold on to the truth, but we become quietly ashamed of gospel teaching. Apostle Paul is not ashamed, and we mustn't be ashamed. We mustn't be ashamed to say we believe that the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, is good news for all kinds of people, from all kinds of backgrounds, with all kinds of baggage and issues that they bring. So I hope that if you're not convinced of that at the beginning of this morning, that by the end of the morning, at least I can have helped you move some way along that direction to believe that the gospel is indeed good news for gay people. And actually, we need to remember, don't we, that God sent his son, Jesus Christ, into the world to die for those who identify themselves as gay or lesbian, whatever description they may use. God sent his son to die for them too. And God wants them to hear the good news of the gospel. He wants them to have an opportunity to respond just as everybody else has an opportunity to respond in repentance to the good news of Jesus Christ. Okay, let me just give you an idea of where we're heading over these two sessions. I'm not quite sure whether it's going to divide up into two quite neatly. We'll see how that goes. But four main headings I want to help us focus our thoughts on this morning. Firstly, we're well underway with this one, cultural trends. We'll come to a bit of personal testimony in a moment. Secondly, we're going to look at just understanding the causes of same-sex attraction. I think that can be a bit of a red herring, the whole question about what causes same-sex attraction. But it is important because I've had people, some of my gay friends will say to me, well, look, I was born gay. If they have a kind of Christian background, they may say, well, God made me this way. Why would a God of love make somebody gay and then deny them the right to be in a same-sex relationship? So it's the kind of justice argument. If God is a good God and he's a just God, why would he possibly do that? So we're going to look at that. Is there any truth in that statement, I was born gay or God made me gay? Thirdly, we'll look at communicating the biblical truth about same-sex practice. I'm assuming that many of us, if not most of us, are involved in teaching and preaching in one way or another, whether that be to young people, whether it be public ministry. And so we're going to think about how can we communicate the biblical truth? How can we communicate a sexual ethic that is completely biblical and yet full of grace and also good? Do we not believe that sex is a good gift from God? I think sometimes as Christians we give this impression that God is the great killjoy, that God is sort of there and he's just saying, no, I don't want you to enjoy any of this. But actually, I believe sex is a really good gift from God. But it's a gift that he has given to be enjoyed exclusively within a certain context. And of course, we will look at that context. And then finally, we'll consider ministering gospel hope to those for whom this is a personal issue. So we're going to think there, does that say three as well? Sorry, that's four. Sorry, this was done a little bit late at night. If there are any other errors, you'll forgive me. That is definitely four. So we're thinking there about really how can we firstly support those within the church, Christian brothers and sisters, genuine Christian brothers and sisters, for whom this is a personal issue, often struggling on their own, often even today with the way the culture's changed, still fearful of admitting it to anybody in church leadership because they fear they're going to get rejected or misunderstood or put out of the church, whatever it may be. Or we're going to be thinking as well about sharing gospel truth with those that we know who are openly gay, who would maybe label themselves in that way. How can we actually share the gospel with them? So that's where we're heading. Give you an idea of when we're approaching the runway and about to land, and all being well, that will be at 12:30. I think I'm sure you all have things you need to do. But I want to try and include plenty of opportunity for questions, and I will try to do that in both sessions, questions and comments as well. Okay, well, let me just, before we move into those other headings, let me just tell you a little bit about my own background. I want you to know that this is not a subject that I teach on from the comfort of some kind of theological bubble. That is often the accusation that's made, isn't it, to church leaders. Oh, well, yeah, it's all very well. You can preach about this, but you don't really understand what the issues are. Well, that isn't an accusation that can be made against me. This is an intensely personal issue for me. I was brought up in a church-going environment. That would probably be the best way to describe it. I was taken to church from a very young age. I was taken to Sunday school. So I grew up with a very clear concept, if you like, of the existence of God. I always believed God was real. I always believed that the Bible was true. Didn't really have any concept at a young age of what it meant to be in relationship with God through Jesus Christ. So I was someone who was trying to live a good life. I was probably what I would now describe as a God-fearer. I had a sense of God and wanted to be moral and to be right and to be a good person. And that was really as far as my understanding went. Around about the age of 10 or 11, I began to be conscious of feeling attractions to some of my male school friends. Initially, that was just purely on an emotional level. Subsequently, that became more physical and sexual in nature. And that was a real concern for me because I already knew at that young age that whatever I'd read in the Bible was very negative about homosexuality, same-sex practice. So here I was as someone who believed in God, believed that the Bible was true, and yet with these emerging feelings and desires which just seemed incompatible really with what God said in his word. So I went through most of my teenage years really trying to resist those feelings, sometimes successfully, mostly actually not, and really often tormenting myself with guilt over what I was feeling and desiring, and really just not knowing how to work this all out. How do I reconcile this with my belief in God? And I would have loved, to be honest, at that stage, excuse me, to be able to, excuse me, let me just take some water. I would have loved at that stage to have been able to talk that through with somebody, but really there was nobody I felt I could talk to. I certainly couldn't talk to my parents. I wasn't going to talk to anybody at school. Things were a lot less open than they would be today. I think people do feel, not always, but they feel increasingly, I think, able to talk to friends at school. And to be honest, the very last place I was going to go was going to be the church, because the only time I'd ever heard people talking on this subject, it was always in a very harsh and very judgmental and very condemning way. So there I was as a teenager, going along to church, trying to be good, trying to sort of please God, and yet conscious that actually deep down, feeling really, not hated by God as such, but pretty much that I didn't really have God's approval. And so I reached the age of 17 and decided that really I needed to make a decision. I couldn't see how the two things could be reconciled. And really, I just couldn't face the prospect, potentially, of being on my own. And that was what I understood to be the Bible's implications for my life. I tried to have girlfriends. I tried not to feel this way, but it just simply wasn't working. And so I came to the conclusion that I must be gay. And that was something that I'd read, I think, in a book on my parents' bookshelf about adolescence. I'd read about this phase that some people have of being attracted to the same sex. I thought, well, if it's a phase, it's a very long phase. It's not going away. And then I came across this word gay, and that seemed to be the right word for me. I didn't want to share that with anybody else. I wasn't going to be open about that. I was never somebody who was kind of out and proud. But it's just that was helpful for me. And I thought, well, this is how I should describe myself. This is who I am. I'm a gay person. As I say, that then created this conflict And so I basically decided that the thought of being alone was too much, and I would set out on this mission almost to try and find somebody that I could spend my life with. I didn't want to be promiscuous, didn't want to have many partners, just wanted to find one special person really to get to know and spend my life with. And I did soon meet a guy of my own age. This was age 17. We became great friends initially, got to know one another, fell in love, and entered into this long-term relationship together. And that lasted from the age of 17 through to 24, so 7 years in total. And then around about the age of 24, there was quite a dramatic turnaround in my life, really. I won't bore you with all of the details, but basically walked into a church one Sunday morning. This was in Bournemouth, just down the coast, where I was living at the time. In fact, I was had been living opposite this church for a couple of years with my partner. We had a flat that overlooked the entrance to this church, big Baptist church down in Bournemouth. And often on a Sunday, I would look out of the window, and I'd see these hundreds of people flooding out of this church, and they'd be laughing and joking and smiling. One of those churches where people are happy, you know, when they come out. There are still a few around. I'm sure you all represent churches like that, don't you? I'm sure your people are happy when they come out. But seriously, though, it just shows, doesn't it, the little things, how they can impact people. There was something about these people that really impacted me. Here I was in a very loving relationship. It wasn't a problem-free relationship, but it was a very good relationship. Had a nice job, a nice income, nice car, pretty much everything I could ask for in life. And yet I saw in these Christian people, just through the window, seeing them come out of church, something that actually made me a bit envious. Like, what is it that they have that I'm lacking? And I think deep down I knew what it was. And God had been working in me clearly over a number of years, and particularly in these last few months, and really convicting me about the way I was living. It wasn't just because of my same-sex relationship. It was actually the fact that I completely drifted away from God and His Word. I'd even kind of given up now trying to please God and to be good. That was just out of my mind. And it was just this increasing sense of conviction that God was working in my heart. So I walked into that church one Sunday morning. Can't tell you much about the service. Can't tell you whether it was user-friendly or not. Can't tell you really what was sung, what was preached. For me, though, all I can say is that on that Sunday morning, there was just such a powerful sense of the presence of God. And it was just, I suppose, for me, being amongst God's people, there was something tangible and yet something that I can't really describe. God was in that place, and it was a very powerful moment. I sat there, and I remember sort of quietly being in tears just throughout the whole service, really, trying to hide that. And I subsequently met with one of the ministers of the church, and this was over coffee, and he kind of looked at me and said, you look like you could do with someone to chat to. And I said, yeah, actually, I think I could. So we met up the following week, and he didn't know anything about my background. I think I did pretty much everything possible to cover up the fact that I was gay. It was never something I was open about. And we met up in his study the following week, and he said, look, I'm just happy to listen to you, but before you talk, would you mind if I just read something to you from the Bible? I said, yeah, sure, whatever, that's fine. So he opened up the Bible and he read to me a very well-known passage, I'm sure many of us will know it here, from Jeremiah chapter 29, where it's written, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity." And whenever I quote those words, they still bring a little bit of a kind of lump to my throat, because that was a very, very powerful moment for me. It was I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but at that moment, it really was as if God was speaking directly to me into my heart. And I remember breaking down in tears, not something I was in the habit of doing, believe me. I'm not that sort of a generally emotional, gushy guy, but it was so powerful that this was God speaking to me. And actually, do you know, it was that last word, captivity, that really struck a chord in my heart. Here I was, I thought I was living a free life. I'd made my choices. I'd made my decisions. I had the things I wanted. I'd always, since a young boy, dreamed of having this special person to share my life with. And I thought that was what would make me happy. And yet, on hearing those words, I recognized that actually, no, what it had done is led me into captivity. Captivity to sin. Captivity to a life that was void of God's presence. And by this stage, I had already heard a number of occasions. I had Christian friends who'd invited me to church, and I had heard by that stage the gospel. I knew what it meant by then to be in relationship with God through Christ. And so I took that passage from Jeremiah as God's call to me, really, to put my trust in Jesus Christ for forgiveness of sins. And that was the beginning, as I say, of a dramatic turnaround in my life. I knew at that very moment of becoming a Christian, in this guy's office, I knew immediately, he didn't have to tell anything, he didn't even know that I was in a same-sex relationship. I knew immediately that coming to faith meant I needed to get out of that relationship. It wasn't an easy thing to do, but such was the clear conviction of God's Spirit and God's Word. I just knew that I had to do that. That was one of the first things I needed to do. But I think I want to stress this morning that becoming a Christian was not in any sense or shape a negative experience. I think sometimes as Christians we talk about all the things we can't do, don't we? And we talk about all the things we have to give up as Christians. And don't get me wrong, clearly, you know, there is a cost to following Jesus Christ. We don't shy away from that. And Jesus himself warns us to count the cost. He talks about taking up our cross and so on. But for me, I have to say my experience of becoming a Christian has been an extremely positive experience. Yes, I had to give up something major, and it was major, but probably my experience has been that exactly what Jesus says. If anyone loses his life for my sake, he will gain it. And that certainly, as I look back, I've been a Christian now just over 20 years. As I look back over those 20 years, yes, there have been struggles and there's been heartache and there have been tears, but I would not want to go back to the life I had before. I would not want to be in that relationship now when I compare it to the joy of being in a relationship with God and Christ and his people. I really wouldn't. Let me just give you one example of how that worked out for me. You know, just as that prophecy from Jeremiah said, really, God having plans to prosper, not to harm me. I didn't have a clue when I was 24, when I became a Christian, what I should be doing with my life. I'd been through a whole host of things in my teenage years and 20s. In fact, it was all the typically gay things for me. So I wanted to be an actor. I went and auditioned at RADA. I wanted to be an air steward. I wanted to be a travel writer. I'm not saying, by the way, if you want to be these things, that means you're gay. Don't misunderstand me, or you know people. Doesn't mean automatic. Those were the typically gay things in my day. And I was a bit lost, really, in terms of vocation. What was I meant to be doing with my life? And I remember on that very day, in fact, that very moment of becoming a Christian, it was, for me, not just about a change in direction, but it was almost like I had this strong conviction that God was wanting me to go and teach this word that had so powerfully worked in my heart to other people. And I remember saying to this minister, I said, look, I want to be a missionary. What do I do? Have you ever had that, you know, new Christian telling you they want to change the world, don't they, new Christians? And of course, he very wisely said, well, you know, hold on, you've just become a Christian, probably good to stay where you are. And it was all very wise. I didn't want to hear it because, you know, I was full of zeal and I wanted to get out there. But it was very wise advice. And it was within a few years that I went up to London to study at Bible College and then subsequently went on to serve in a church in East London as an assistant minister and youth worker initially and then as the pastor of that church. And I served there for 10 years. And that was before joining the staff of True Freedom Trust. Let me just tell you a little bit about our ministry before we move on. Somebody was asking me this morning, tell me a little bit about True Freedom Trust, who are you? And somebody else was saying, how long have you been around? We've actually been around since 1977, believe it or not. People are quite surprised by that. I haven't been involved that long, but it started in 1977. Basically, we are a ministry that is passionate about two things. Firstly, helping the church and Christians to think about these issues of same-sex attraction particularly, both in a biblical way and in a grace-filled way. And we believe passionately you can bring those two things together. So you can be absolutely biblical, but you can be absolutely full of grace in the way that you communicate that truth. So we do a lot of teaching, whether it's at events such as this or at conferences, youth groups, Sunday mornings, midweek meetings for churches, a lot of Bible colleges as well, helping sort of train people for future ministry. And then alongside that, we're also very passionate about working with people individually for whom this is a personal issue. So that's Christians, those who perhaps, like myself, have come to faith and they've left a same-sex relationship or a more actively gay lifestyle, as it's sometimes called. Or in fact, many more people that we support are Christians who've grown up, often grown up within the church, aware that this is an issue. Maybe they've never even used that term gay, but they're conscious of same-sex attractions, and we seek to provide biblical support and encouragement to them. There's a whole load of literature and various books out on the table, so please do take an opportunity in the coffee break to have a look through that. If you want to ask me any more about the ministry, please feel free to do that. Okay, let's move on to our second heading, understanding the causes of same-sex attraction. Now, I'm going to give you a little 2-3 minute break from listening to me. I think that's always a good thing to do. And just ask you maybe to turn to 3-4 people around you and think about this question. I made that statement earlier on about people saying that they're born this way and God made them this way. What do we think? Are people born gay? Are people born gay? Have a little chat, maybe 3-4 people around you, just 2 minutes, and then we'll come back and maybe share some of what we've come up with. Okay, let's come back together. Maybe just 3 or 4 of us could share something that we sort of talked about in our group. Are people born gay? Did anybody just say yes and move on and talk about something else? No, I didn't think. He seems to be more engrossed in conversation. What did we come up with? Any thoughts? Any thoughts? Come on, be brave. Yes. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Other thoughts?
Yeah.
Okay, no, that's fine, yeah.
If we are thinking of people born with same-sex attraction,
yeah,
then I might be more inclined to answer that question, yes.
Okay.
But there might be a difference between that and gay as an identity.
Yeah, okay, that's a very, very important point. Yeah, we might pick up on identity in a moment. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Okay, right, yeah. Okay. Okay. So possibly a bit of both, yeah? Okay, one more comment. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that's suggesting potentially there are environmental, relational factors at play. Okay. Yeah. That's great. Just to pick up on that identity issue, I think this is a really important one, and I think this is something we need to think about carefully as Christians. And I should stress that for me now, I don't call myself gay. I don't call myself a gay Christian. There's a number of reasons for that, not least because it could lead to all sorts of misunderstanding about what I believe. But mainly, actually, because that is not my identity. For me now, it's really important that my identity is in Christ. Okay, that's the only way I want to be called a Christian. I don't want to be called gay. And actually, I think as Christians, this is one of the ways we can be countercultural, is actually just to very gently resist this tendency. And it happens within the church. You know, I've heard young people at youth groups talking about, well, I'm gay, I'm straight, I just don't think we should be describing ourselves in that way. That's not a biblical concept at all. I don't think God looks at any of us and says, oh, that one's gay, that one's straight. Show me anywhere in the Bible where anybody is described according to who they're sexually attracted to. I would love it if somebody one day would prove me wrong, but I really don't think you will. There is no example in the Bible where we're urged or encouraged or whether there's any example of somebody describing themselves according to who they're sexually attracted to. I do not think it's biblical, and I think we can be countercultural in that. So, yeah, I don't describe myself in that way. One of the things I didn't share with you earlier on, and maybe I ought to clarify this point, sometimes people ask me, well, you know, what about your wife and five children? You didn't mention them. Well, I didn't mention them because they don't exist, okay? So I should stress, if I were to be pushed for a description, I would say I'm a Christian who has an ongoing struggle with same-sex attraction. It's not the struggle it used to be, but it's still a struggle. It's not my only struggle. I have lots of other struggles as well, as most Christians do. So I'm a Christian who is seeking now by God's grace to live a single and a celibate, and I want to stress a really fulfilled life as a single guy, okay? It's not a sad life. It's not a lonely life. It's not a frustrating life. It's a very full life. Sure, there are moments of sadness, loneliness, and frustration, but then that's true for every single one of my married friends, I can assure you. Those that are honest with me, they have their moments of sadness and loneliness and frustration. And quite possibly, I wouldn't like to comment on that. Somebody just got a whack, I think, from their partner. But I think it's really important. This is something we'll pick up on later again. The church's attitude to singleness and to single people, I think, is something we really need to be thinking about as well. And let me be very honest with you, Simon. I think it's really important that I'm honest with you, this being an issue with which I struggle. You know, I'm not claiming that in the 20 years that I've been a Christian, I have lived this life of celibacy and purity perfectly. Okay, I'm just going to be perfectly honest with you because I don't want you to get that impression. It's been a struggle. There have been times where I have slipped up and fallen and failed. There have been times where I've got kind of too emotionally involved in a male friendship, even within the church. I've had to kind of work my way through that. There have been several seasons of my Christian life where, honestly, I could have slipped right back into a same-sex relationship. That's the reality. But all I can do this morning is share with you my testimony of a God of incredible grace, incredible mercy and patience and forbearance. And every time I foolishly begun to take steps back in that direction, every single time, he has graciously sometimes disciplined me, sometimes rebuked me, sometimes through other Christians gently getting alongside me. But he's every time picked me up and got me back onto that narrow road, which of course Jesus spoke of, which is a road that's hard to travel, but it is the road, of course, that leads to life. So just want to have that moment of honesty before you this morning. And let's be honest again, that is going to be the reality. Believe me, that is going to be reality for most of those in your church for whom this is an issue. It is going to be an ongoing struggle for most of them. Some of them will slip up. Some of them will get involved in same-sex practice. And what they'll need is real gracious, careful, cautious pastoral care, not judgment. It won't help. They really need support and encouragement. And that may include, a word of rebuke and correction. But again, we'll pick up on that a little bit later. Let's just go back then to this question, are people born gay? And I think somebody said, tweaking the question, it's actually maybe not the best question, in fact, but I've put it there for that very reason, to highlight that. And in fact, what we need to accept, most experts would accept that we need to really hold to this multi-causation model when it comes to the development of our sexual attraction. So for those who experience mostly, predominantly, exclusively, perhaps same-sex attraction, there are likely to be a number of different factors at play. So that may include biological, genetic factors. Now, some Christians have a real problem with this, and they get really hung up on it, and they think, oh, how could there possibly be, you're basically saying then there is a gay gene, are you? I'm not saying that at all. There's been no proof at all that there's a gay gene. There's been no proof that there's a set of genes that make somebody gay. What we're saying is that there are likely to be, why not, biological and genetic factors that impact the way our sexual attraction develops. Let's face it, they impact pretty much everything else about us, don't they? What we look like, our temperament, it's all affected by biology and by genes. So why not people's sexual attractions? As I say, I don't believe for one moment anybody is going to discover a gay gene. I just do not think it's going to be as simple as that. But let me say that even if they did, even if tomorrow it were published in all of the best, medical journals, we've actually proved that people are born with a fixed orientation, it would actually do nothing to change what I believe passionately about same-sex practice. Why? Well, if we've got our gospel heads on, we'll know, won't we, that we are born into a fallen, broken world. We're not born into Genesis 1 and 2 times. We're born in Genesis 3 times now. Each of us has a fallen nature. What did David the psalmist say? Surely I was sinful when? At birth. sinful from the time my mother conceived me. So even if there is a genetic element, or it were proved somehow that there's, that, you know, people are born this way, it would do nothing to me to convince me of anything that the Bible says about same-sex practice is not to be taken seriously. To me, a gay gene would be a gene that is simply crying out, like the rest of the world, groaning for redemption and for rescue. We're born into a fallen world. We all of us have a fallen nature. And in fact, if we're honest, all of us have a fallen sexuality. Not one of us is able to have a perfect sexuality. You know, those of us who are married in great relationships, it's not perfect, is it? The way we think about sex is not perfect for any one of us. And there are a group of people for whom it's mostly going to be same-sex attraction, but actually most other people in the church will also struggle sexually, but they'll struggle with opposite-sex attraction. The Bible doesn't actually distinguish much between the two. So potentially biological genetic factors. This is just to prove this point that it's not as simple as saying people are born gay. This is Dr. Francis S. Collins, head of the Human Genome Project. He's talking here about a study that was undertaken of identical male twins over in the USA. And this was where one of the twins was exclusively or predominantly attracted to those of the same sex. What's the likelihood that the other one would be too? Obviously, if it was purely genetic, it would be 100%. They're identical twins. But he found this, looking at this evidence, he said evidence from twin studies does in fact support the conclusion that heritable factors play a role in male homosexuality. However, the likelihood that the identical twin of a homosexual male will also be gay is about 20%. Now, that's quite high compared to 2 to 4% of males in the general population, but it's nowhere near 100%. And he says, and I like this phrase here, indicating, he says, that sexual orientation is genetically influenced but not hardwired by DNA, and that whatever genes are involved represent predispositions, not predetermination. So it may well be that certain people, certain Christians, are born with a predisposition to being attracted to those of the same sex. Just as somebody, I mean, there's a lot of research going on at the moment about, you know, is it possible to be born alcoholic? You know, a mum who drinks in the womb, potentially. Some people are talking now, doing research on anger gene. Is it possible to be born with an anger gene? You know, and it may well be proved one day that it is. Does that then give the Christian who has the anger gene the right to fly off the handle at everybody? Absolutely not. That's something that has to be brought over time under the control of God's Holy Spirit. And in the same way, somebody has a predisposition towards same-sex attraction. Doesn't mean they then go and live in a same-sex relationship. It means that that needs to be brought under the control of God's Holy Spirit. So there are others then who focus on environmental factors, and somebody over here helpfully pointed that out, that there are various research that's been done talking about environmental factors. So let me give you a couple of examples. Some people say that attendance at a single-sex boarding school can be a factor which influences some people in the development of their sexuality. Now, it so happens that I went to a single-sex boarding school myself from the age of 8 to 13, and I look back on that time, and I have to say I'm personally convinced that that was quite a big factor in my case in the development of same-sex attraction. I remember on a Saturday, this was in Oxford where I was brought up, born and brought up, and we were told, we had school on a Saturday morning, wonderful, and then we were told on a Saturday afternoon we were allowed to go out, this is the head teacher in an assembly, you're allowed to go out into town, look around the shops on a Saturday afternoon, you must go in a group of a minimum of four boys, he said, and whatever you do, under no circumstances are you to talk to girls. Seriously, that was the instruction we were given. So here you are, you know, a group of sort of adolescents, you know, hormones beginning to rage around the body. Under no circumstances, you know, direct any of that towards girls. You know, that's just wrong. So you can see it. So my introduction to the opposite sex was, well, girls are just this scary creature that you just never talk to. You know, I have some, you met a few girls who are quite scary, but that's a different story. I've met a few guys who are quite scary as well, but we won't go there. But do you see how that's actually a really unhelpful way to introduce a young boy entering adolescence to the opposite sex? It's not helpful. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I am not saying, therefore, single-sex schools make people gay. That would be the wrong conclusion to reach simply because of my experience. And some of us here may have had experience of going to single-sex schools and it's not impacted our sexual desires at all. What I'm saying is it could be a factor. Other environmental factors, I've had boys who've talked to me about their issues who've said that actually they've grown up in an all-female environment. So they grew up, they had maybe two, three sisters, dad wasn't around. So all they had as they were growing up was the female influence. One of the reasons why I passionately believe that children generally should have a mum and a dad. And that would be my reason for being against gay adoption, which is, you know, is obviously people are able to do that now, and that will increasingly be so. My main reason for being opposed to it is actually because I personally believe every child should have a mum and a dad, where possible. That's not to say that, you know, it's life over if you don't, and God can work with those families, and I know of children who've grown up fantastically well having only one parent, but I don't think that's God's ideal. So that can be a factor as well. And linked in with that is this sort of relational fact. So a lot of research has been done, and it's very difficult to prove these things, but people talk about relationship with the same-sex parents. So, for example, boys maybe not having a very good relationship with their dad as they're growing up, girls not having a very good relationship with their mum. And the kind of thinking behind this, it's all quite complex, but the kind of thinking behind this is if you're growing up and you're not having a right relationship with your same-sex parent, in a sense, you know, you take a boy, you know, masculinity is going to be modelled to him by his dad. And if there's something not quite right in that relationship, then he potentially could end up with a wrong view of what it means to be a man. Now, my concern with all of this, and I've had parents on the phone in tears to me saying, you know, it's all our fault and our son is blaming us or our daughter's blaming us. And this is the problem. It shouldn't lead to a blame culture. We're not saying, oh, well, it's the parent's fault. But what we're saying is maybe there could be factors to do with relationships within the family that have had an impact. So, you know, certainly this is played out in people that I've talked with, and quite a lot of guys particularly, I would say, where they themselves would say, you know, I just always really wanted, you know, someone to give me a hug, or I wanted a close friend. I didn't actually want sex at all. It was really all about affection. And there seems to be something, as this lady over here mentioned, something lacking, something that they were desiring. And you can imagine if that lack is recognized at adolescence, how easily everything becomes sexualized at adolescence. So actually, oh, I really wish I could just have a little bit of affection and affirmation. How easily that can become sexualized into, you know, I just the whole body and mind gets so confused, doesn't it? This is played out in relationships at school as well. So, for example, people not relating very well to their same-sex peer group. Again, I've heard this so many times. Young people saying, and forgive me if I'm using the male examples all the time, it's just that that's obviously my own personal experience. And a lot of what I'm saying, I will try to use the female examples as well. But example of a guy, for example, growing up. You imagine a guy growing up in school not being very good at sport. Now, we know, don't we, guys, culturally, that being good at sport is quite important in our culture. It's quite important in terms of if you're good at sport, you tend to be quite popular. You tend to have quite a nice physique if you're good at sport. You tend to be quite confident if you're good at sport. So you imagine a young person growing up who's not very good at sport and is sort of feeling, well, I don't really fit in with my same-sex peer group. And they're desperate to want to be affirmed and accepted, and they want to be confident. And then they see this guy who is really good at sport, and he's got a great physique, and he's really confident, and he's really popular. And you can see how in a young person's mind, oh, I wish I was like that person. And wish I was like that person can so easily become a sort of an admiration of that person. And again, in adolescence, how easily that can become sexualized. So I wish I was like that person to, oh, isn't that person attractive? And it then so easily becomes. Now, as I say, I can't prove any of this to you. This is a sort of personal experience of talking to other people, reading and so on. But I have to say, I do see this kind of thing. People again and again talking to me, how it began by a kind of a crush on the popular kid at school. And this is where it began. And I think understanding a little bit of some of the roots of these things can be helpful when it comes to pastoral care. Not that we try and fix people. I'm assuming most of us here are probably not psychologists. We're not trained counselors necessarily. But just having an understanding of the roots can sometimes be helpful. And actually, one of the best things you can sometimes do, if somebody comes to you as a church leader, as a friend, and opens up to you that this is a personal struggle for them, rather than rush in trying to fix it or to quote a scripture, just listen to their story. Ask them about it. And I tell you, there are people in your churches who will be crying out for somebody just to listen to them. Get alongside, listen to their story, and ask them. Say, well, you know, when did this start? When do you think this came from? And they probably will have their own theories. Quite often they do. So I would encourage you to do that. One writer says this, just talking about this multi-causation model, this would mean, he says, that the form and strength of each person's same-sex desire has a distinctive, perhaps unique mix of biological and psychological factors. And it may be better to speak of homosexualities in the plural. I think that's actually a very helpful comment. It's just recognizing, isn't it, that we're all unique in God's eyes. We're all knit together in our mother's wombs by God. And so the way I look at it is that different factors are likely to influence different people in different ways. So I can't take my story and what I believe is the root cause of my same-sex attraction and apply that to everybody else. There may be things that are true for me and for others, but I can't make that assumption. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there, and we've got 10 minutes now for questions and comments, maybe just restricting them to this first part. There'll be